Bob, I'm an alcoholic. This brings us to step four, the bottom of page 63, immediately after taking the third step prayer. It says, Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted, though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. At once. Next. You know what my experience is? I think we got this dog ears thing going on with stuff like that. It's like next and at once to most people means like next and at once. To us, it's like somewhere down the road. You know, it's like 6 months later, 2 years later. And I think one of the reasons it says next and at once is that what I've observed is the longer I wait, the crazier I become. I have a guy that I sponsor. I just gave him a cake for 18 years. And when Craig was sober a year and maybe close to a year and a half, he started his fourth step. He didn't finish it or do his fifth step until he was almost 3 years sober. It took him over a year and a half to do next. And I'll tell you what happened to him in that time. He started having an affair with a married woman. He started carrying an Uzi machine gun in his Bronco because they were back. You know who they are. You don't know who they are in particular, but they're out there. And he started becoming more and more judgmental and full of anxiety. He started suffering from depression. He had frantic bouts of gratification trying to fix himself. And he got crazy. I want to read a little passage out of the 12 by 12 where Bill describes very explicit description of what it's like to suffer from untreated alcoholism as a result of not really cleaning house. It says in the 12 by 12, it says, some people are unable to stay sober at all. Others will relapse periodically until they really clean house. Even AA old-timers sober for years often pay dearly for skimping this step. They will tell how they tried to carry the load alone. When I was new in sobriety, I did about a year sober, I did my first four step, and I didn't follow the directions in the book. I did the 40-page life story of everything I was ashamed of, felt guilty about, and nothing changed. And when I was four and a half, I started to suffer from untreated alcoholism, and it was awful. And I did it right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous with a good job and a good life, going to 10 meetings a week. And what I'm going to read, the next couple sentences, is exactly where I was at, exactly. It says, they tell how they tried, and I was sober, I would have thought myself an old-timer, sober for years, even though not by today's standard I was sober for over 4 years. But this thing about how we tried to carry the load alone, it like my life got heavy and I got serious and everything was a big deal. It goes on to say how much they suffered of irritability. Oh man, I was like that. I was on the muscle with people. I'd fly off the handle with them. I was very judgmental, very withdrawn because they would irritate me. Suffer from irritability. Anxiety. My worrying was back to full speed ahead. The way my head would spin and the things I was. I lived in a constant state of low level apprehension. Remorse. I suffered from remorse. You know that feeling, like it's like a placeless, faceless type of shame. It's just a tremendous sense of being, of missing the mark, of not being right, of feeling guilty. And I don't know exactly, specifically, what particular thing I feel remorseful or guilty about. It's just a feeling that I suffer from, as if I'm remorseful for my very life, or life itself, or my failure to be something I thought I should have been. Suffered from irritability, anxiety, remorse, and depression. And I once again, it was started having bouts of depression that I hadn't had since I was a newcomer. Since I was, I went through a period of about a year or so after doing my first four step where I seemed to be free of that to some extent, and then it returned again. It returned because I'd skimped on this step. I hadn't really followed the process in the book. And when you don't follow the process of the book, what happens is when you come to step 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, you're lost. I mean, the pieces of the puzzle, when it don't fit together. It's almost like putting together a jigsaw puzzle and ignoring one piece, and taking a piece of cardboard and cutting it just so, pretending it's going to be the right piece, and you put it in place and it fits with the piece because you've cut it to fit in that one piece. But then you go to put the other pieces in place around it, and they don't fit because it's not the right piece. It fit with the pieces that were there, just like my four steps seemed to fit with the first three according to my view of what was going on. But when it came time to go on with the rest of the program, I was lost. I was lost. Suffering from irritability, anxiety, remorse, and depression. I just seemed to get my life and my emotions on me. And it's not clinical depression, even though a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous get misdiagnosed suffering from this type of spiritual depression as being clinically depressed. What I was experiencing in actuality was the depression of the overly self-involved. The depression of the guy who plays God and can't really pull it off. I was suffering from the depression of running the show. I heard a great definition of depression. Depression's when God stops doing my will. When God, no, depression, I even got a better, just thought of a better one. Depression is when God will not relinquish my job. Right. The job I've always known I would do better. How I suffered irritability, anxiety, remorse, and depression, and how this put me right over the top, and how unconsciously seeking relief from the way I feel, we would sometimes accuse even our very best friends of the very character defects we ourselves were trying to conceal. And that's exactly what had happened to me. Not only was I irritable and anxious and prone to depression, but I became very, very judgmental. I found myself relentlessly taking people's inventories, and all of a sudden that consciousness returned, that sick consciousness of separation where you sit in a meeting and you just judge everybody. And that consciousness that you can't help it. You just notice you don't look at people in a loving kind of good way. You look at them for fault. And you just know, you get that noticer turned on. You know, the noticer that just notices, listens to the word, listens for the imperfections, listens to you to share in a meeting, and what an idiot that guy is. Jesus. Oh, listen to this. Oh, what a phony. Sounds like a Hallmark card in a recovery bookstore. Am I supposed to buy that crap? Look, doesn't put any money in the basket. Look at him. He's just trying to get laid, grandstanding in front of these women. Jeez, what this? And I was leaving AA. Didn't even know it. Never left the rooms. But I was leaving AA. suffering from alcoholism, in a state of separation between me and you. And I was lucky enough to have been exposed to my friend Charlie, Don P., Franklin W., Wesley P., and some guys that had, by this time I'd spent a lot of time with and had showed me how to do this deal, and I went back. And by this time, I had already helped other guys that I sponsored to do it, but I'd never done it. And I went back and I did the process as it's outlined in the big book. And when I did this, I'll tell you something, nothing I have ever done in my life has changed me more, except maybe with the possible exception of sponsoring a lot of guys and doing a lot of 12-step work. The two of those things together have changed me more than anything. They've opened the channel, allowed God's grace into my life. The book says here that we're looking to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Blocking me from what? From being happy or successful? I think blocking me from carrying out the decision I just made in step three. When I said to my maker, God, I offer myself to thee for you to build with me and do with me as you will. Blocking me from actually carrying that out, to actually making my life none of my business. So, and asking him to relieve me of the bondage of self and to take away those difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I'm going to help, that I would help. I'm blocked from carrying out the decision. As we all know, and I was the guy in early sobriety that would say in meetings where in discussion meetings where the subject was the third step, I would say, well, I turn it over and take it back. I turn it over and take it back. I never turn it over. I did it intellectually. I could see the value in turning it over. But I am still blocked by the things in me which I have not uncovered and be rid of that force a guy like me to desperately defend their judgments, the things they're convinced they're right about, my judgments of people, all my resentment lists. My wrongs were how I was wrong about you, how wrong I was about my mom and dad, how wrong I was about the women in my life, the employers I had, how wrong I was about the police. All self-centered judgments based on self that I'd made, how wrong I was in my fears. I believed my fears more than I believed the possibility of change. I was one of those, oh, I can't do that guy. I was, that wouldn't work for me. I believed the fears more than I would take the risk of change. So I was hostage to my own fears. I was blocked not only from carrying out the decision in step three, but I was also blocked from God. I remember in my early sobriety, I remember getting to a place where I knew God was in my life and I knew I was sober as a result of him. But I seemed to be cut off. God once again became hypothetical. He became air that I prayed to. There was no more conscious contact. I was aware of no presence in my life. It was almost as if I was cut off. And the things I would hear in meetings where people talked about the God within me there was no God anymore. Within me there was just a pack of crazy people running around. There was chatter all the time. I could not go within for intuitive thought or inspiration. There was no small, quiet voice of God within me. Or if it was there, and I believe it was so obscured, so blocked off by calamity and pomp and worship of other things. I was blocked from God. And I was also blocked from you. As an alcoholic, I lived in a peculiar sense of loneliness, a state of separation, where I could sit in the middle of a whole group of people that I knew intellectually accepted me and loved me, and yet felt separate and disconnected, blocked in an inability to connect and integrate myself with you the way you seem to so easily do with each other. And I didn't know that from you, by my own judgments, my own resentments, my own fears, the defense mechanisms that I had put into place because I'm scared and I can't trust God. The defense mechanisms I put into place to protect me, to keep me safe, because I don't know what you're going to do in the world, and you and people in particular are threatening. But the walls I put up to protect me from you kept me a prisoner alone with me. And I could not get free. I was blocked. The book says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about stock and trade. When I did my first inventory and I wrote the 40 pages of all the things I felt guilty and ashamed about, I did not find any new facts about me and face any new facts. There was no new information on there. I did not discover any truth. When I shared that with another human, with another member of AA, and read that 40 pages of gruel to them, everything on there I knew about. There was no new information. I was there. The only benefit that I got out of that was, I got two benefits out of it. Is for a little while, I didn't feel guilty in meetings where the subject was step four, because I could point to that and say, well, I did it. Even though there was a gnawing, persistent feeling as time went on that maybe I really didn't do it. But I don't want to be wrong about I don't want to be wrong about saying that I did it I don't want to be the guy who has to come and say, well, I didn't really do it. I don't like being wrong. And the only thing of real value that I got out of it, I think, is that I shared some secrets with another human being that I'd never shared with anybody else before. And I guess, in a sense, that bought me enough time to eventually stay sober physically long enough to survive my disease, to come back and do the thing that we're going to talk about in this next portion of the book. And nothing has changed me. It was the change to this day. I've never been the same as a result of this. And I don't think I'll ever will be the same. I may drink again one day, because there are no guarantees. If I stop doing AA and stop treating this disease of the spirit, I am eligible for that. But on the path to that destruction, the one thing that will be different is that I will never, ever again really be able to convince myself that I'm the victim, that you're doing this to me. Coming out of this step, I will never able to fall back into that again. I always knew the truth, and I always will. So it's an effort to find and face some facts about myself, an effort to discover the truth about stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of a business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. And I fooled myself a lot about values. I justified a lot of bad behavior and bad attitudes and bad treatment of others because I could point to something they did and feel justified, and never had to clear up my side of the street. I had a lot of screwy, double-edged values that, like, if rationalizations why I did something. If you'd have done the same thing to me, it would have made me crazy. But it was okay because I did it because I had a reason. Right? I had crazy values. Crazy, crazy values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, remember the book said selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. The inventory process is in three parts: resentment, fears, sex conduct. And I didn't know for a long time why they said resentment is the number one offender. I wouldn't have said resentment. I would have thought it should be guilt or shame. Because when I got sober, I was plagued with guilt from the things I did. And I'll tell you what I've discovered about guilt and why guilt's not the number one offender. Matter of fact, guilt, there's not even a section in the inventory about guilt. Even though Everything I ever felt guilty about would fall into my fear inventory, because if there's always a fear of being, every guilt I ever had involved a fear of being found out, or a fear of facing that person, or a fear of consequences. So there, all the everything that would have been, if I could have made a guilt list, would have actually ended up on my fear list. But the reason the guilt's not the number one offender, there are things that I did when I was 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, that at the time I did them, and for a period of time afterwards, I was racked with guilt. Felt awful. Tremendous fear of getting caught. Shame. Wondered who found out. Did anybody see me? All kinds of stuff like that. But I'll tell you the funny thing about guilt. As I get away from the incident, the actions I took that caused the guilt, one of two things happens. Either the discomfort drives me to take action to put the guilt at rest, or I will suffer the pangs of apartness from the guilt long enough to get into the zone where I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's no chance ever of any consequences for this. It's really I'm out of the woods, and then I'm no longer guilty. I got crap from when I was a little kid. I probably didn't even get on my eight-step list because it was so much stuff I couldn't remember everything, that I am sure that when I did it, I felt guilty. It's been so long ago, I've forgotten completely about it. I'm no longer guilty. Sometimes some of that stuff pops up. I've had stuff pop up at 15 and 20 years sober that I thought that I didn't remember. I'll see somebody else do something and I remember, oh my God, I did that when I was a kid. Jeez, I never cleaned that up. Oh, gee. But I don't feel guilty. It was out of sight, out of mind. But resentments, now that's a whole nother breed of cat. I got sober. I had case files on teachers from the first and second grade. I knew the first guy I ever got in a fight with, the first girl ever rejected me, resentments are forever. I never forget that. Matter of fact, not only don't I forget them, as the years go by, I add to the file. Right? I build the case bigger. They never go away. They never go away. And even the ones where I think they're gone away, if I see that guy, God, I'm so glad I saw him. I almost forgot how much I hated him. Right? Instantaneous. Resentment is the number one offender. The book says it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. I think it destroys more alcoholics than alcohol. I'm telling you, I've watched people die in sobriety from their own hand. And it started with resentments that eventually they judged themselves right into a corner and they had nowhere to go. I didn't know what resentment was. I thought that resentment was anger. And it's not really anger. Even though sometimes it looks a little bit like anger, but there's a really big difference between anger and resentment. I'll give you an example. If I'm out in the garage and I'm building a birdhouse for the backyard. Like I need another one. I'm building a birdhouse for the backyard and I'm hammering nails into wood and I slip and I hit my thumb with the hammer. I am going to get angry. I'm going to cuss that hammer and throw that hammer across the garage. That's anger, very normal. It's a defensive, explosive reaction to being threatened or hurt. Now, resentment, which comes from a Latin word, resentire, meaning to resensitize, refeel, is that 5 weeks later, I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to get even with that goddamn hammer. You know? And I'm replaying the incident and what that hammer did to me, and I'm going to get even. And the problem with this resensitizing, this refeeling, this replaying, wouldn't be so bad if I did it with the mind of a normal person. But I do it with the mind of a chronic alcoholic, a fear-based perception that is overly judgmental and overly defensive. So what happens is as I replay the incident, just like in a football game, where in a football game they have the instant replay, they play back the play, except I play it back with an alcoholic mind that kind of shades out anything I might have kind of done that might have been out of line, and I zoom that camera in on what you did, and then I got a little commentator. I got a little Howard Cosell voice that starts talking about the awful things that they did, and then I play it again, and I make it a little more awful, and zoom in a little closer on what you did. And by this time, my part doesn't even, it's not even on the screen anymore. It's not even, it's insignificant, because look what you did here. And then if I retaliated and did something against you, I diminish that and I kind of put it right next to what they did. And it's like, yeah, but see, this made me do this. I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have gossiped about you. I wouldn't have hurt you. I wouldn't have done that if you hadn't. You made me do that. If you wouldn't have done that, you deserved that. And I feel completely justified in my behavior. And I lived with a lot of that. No wonder I couldn't hear God. No wonder I was locked up inside myself and disconnected and alone. You got 10 or 20 things going on like that, you're a prisoner. Right in here of the tapes that you play continually. You're a prisoner, as I was. The book says, from it stem all forms of spiritual dis-ease. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. And if you've ever had a deep-seated resentment, you feel sick of spirit. You don't feel vital and alive and connected. You're withdrawn and locked up and sick inside. You may feel justified in the hope of being right, but it don't feel good. Don't feel good. I was with a guy not too long ago, a guy I sponsored, and he started his fourth step, and he comes to me, he says, you know, I can't think of anybody I'm resentful for at. I don't have any resentments. I said, really? You don't have anybody that's pissed you off? Hey, not really. I'm kind of an easygoing guy. I said, really? He said, yeah, nobody really bugs me too much. I said, okay, in your case, let's look at it a little different. Let's make a list of people you feel smugly superior to. And he gets this look on his face and he goes, oh, that's a long list. Oh, yeah. That's a long list. The people that you play it over and over again of how out of line they are and how better you are and how I'd never have done that and how you pump yourself up and you blow yourself up into prideful, in a prideful balloon with the illusion that you're better than them. Every resentment I ever had a sick, secret feeling of superiority attached to it. I always felt somewhere smugly superior to the people I resented. That's pathetic, but it's true. It's true. So we have not only been physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, and this is the promise, when the spiritual malady is overcome, when I can clear the stuff that blocks me from doing the deal in step three, that blocks me from you, when I can re-again integrate myself and attain the unity that I've always yearned for, and also integrate myself once again with God, when I am spiritually no longer sick and separate, because spiritual sickness is really a state of separation. That's why spiritually sick people feel overly lonely. Spiritually sick people are prone to two symptoms, anxiety and depression. So when the spiritual malady is overcome, cause and effect, when I'm not driven in here by a state of separation and I have nothing to defend and the amends are made and everything's clean and it's a clear and clean channel, I have nothing that forces me up here to churn on, to replay, to do nothing. I'm clean. Then mentally, I'm not a whack job anymore. And as a result of not being a whack job, that thing, my ulcer will go away. The migraine headaches go away. The spastic colitis. I don't have a tendency to I'm not building a tumor anymore around the people I I get better physically and mentally. I get better physically and mentally. Because I am I am at one. Once again, as I was born to be. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed. So I'm making a list. I'm going back through my life and I'm listing everyone I've ever felt smugly superior to, everyone that's ever annoyed me or pissed me off or not done it right or hurt my feelings or stole from me or cheated. What I'm really listing, if you were to ask me as I was making the list, nobody ever asked me or I would have thrown me into a tailspin. But if you would have asked me, I might have told you that what I'm really listing here is that this is kind of a list of all the people that if they ever got a program would really owe me an amends. Right? Isn't it? Right? All the people that really would owe me an amends, really. And I was told at this point, because I don't want to look bad, and I don't want to look childish, and I don't want to look infantile and stupid, that to not to allow my natural inclination to minimize the resentments, to indulge my childish pettiness and really bring it all out. All the pathetic little judgments of, and I don't even want anybody to know that I could be that infantile. Put them all down. Indulge it. Put them all down. The people that didn't invite me to the potluck, you know, every little bit, you know, put the guy that, the chairman of the meeting that didn't call on me, and I had the real definitive stuff too, you know. The girl that I was probably would have married, and she went with that crap head instead. Put her down. Put them all down. Everybody that ever hurt me. And then it said we listed the people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. Most of it, for me, was people. There was a couple institutions, a couple principles. Common institution people have on their list, IRS. A principle. I had one guy that had the 50, well, back in the days when it was federal law, it was 55 miles an hour on federal highways. He resented that. The principle that somebody has to tell him. And there's something about the alcoholic that we don't want to admit that certain principles bug us, but there's a part of us that always suspects we're above the law. You know, those handicapped parking lot signs should be enforced for people who are inconsiderate. But I'm only going to be a minute, and I am in a hurry. The speed limit is very, very good, and you people really should stick to it. Can't you see it's for your own good? It's for the good of everybody else. But I'm in a hurry. It's okay. As if I'm above the law, right? As if I have such an over-exaggerated sense of myself as if I'm a special case. As if it applies to everybody else, but not me. My case is different. I need to drive 70. See, your life is pathetic and unimportant. I'm in a hurry here. Right? It's awful. Isn't that awful to think that way? I've had those thoughts, though. I've been that guy in traffic that acts as if he thinks he's so special, right, that I don't have to drive the speed limit. And I got a traffic record to prove it. It's awful, I'm telling you. I'm getting a lot better over the years. We thank God it's progress, not perfection. Oh, my God. We ask ourselves why we were angry, column number two. So if you're looking on page 65, there's three columns. Column number one, people, institutions, principles. Who are we angry at? Who do I feel smugly superior to? Who has pissed me off? Who has hurt me? Column number one. Column number two, you got who. Column number two is why. Who, why? Why am I angry? What did they do to me? What's the deal here? And if you'll notice on page 65, the answers in column number two are very distinct, short, to the point. And I suspect that it's that way because it's supposed to be. I think that there is an inclination in me to build these wordy, verbal, verbose cases against people that are just meaningless fluff. And it's all peripheral crap just to justify the fact that I hate them and that they're wrong. But what's the truth? What was really hurt? What did they really do? What really got the ball rolling? I had a second grade teacher. If I could have indulged myself, I would have put her down. I could have wrote pages on why I resented her, what she did to Johnny and what she did to my friend Billy and Tommy, and how she was just a self-righteous old broad, and that she just, the vow of celibacy had made her fluids back up, and she hated men, and she was crazy, and she, their habit was too tight, and you know, oh, I would have gave you this big case, but it was all crap. It was all crap. It was all the stuff I frantically needed to justify my hating her. You know what the truth was? She got me up in front of the class and embarrassed me in front of everybody because I hadn't done my homework. And from that moment on, I had a case built, and she could not do anything right from that moment on. I built that case, and I looked at her in such a perception that every time she'd talk, she'd punish another kid. I'd just go, yeah, look at her, that bitch. Right? But what really happened is she embarrassed me in front of the class for not doing my homework. Column number 3, in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbook, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So I'm looking for the things that were hurt or threatened in column number 3. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. So where it says in column 3, affects Maya, I'm looking for the things that might have been affected, might have been hurt, threatened, injured. Was it our self-esteem, our security? And Bill in the 12 by 12 breaks security into two forms. He talks about emotional security. We all know what that is. Our comfort zone, if you screw with it, I get crazy. Or my material security. We all know what that is. My ambitions, which ambitions is just another fancy way of saying my little plans and designs. It's me. When you interfere with my ambition, you're interfering with me getting my own way. It's really. Our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with. We are usually as definite as these examples, and it gives the list. And then down at the very bottom of the third column, the first thing under the wife, and it's very important, it says pride. Pride's a big deal. Pride cometh before a fall, they say. I have a friend that talks about the 7 deadly sins. He says there's pride, lust, and 5 others. Those are the 2. And pride's a big deal. When my pride's threatened, I'll go crazy. Death before embarrassment. I mean, pride is such a powerful force in human nature that there are cultures where suicide is socially acceptable if you lose face. Harry Carey. How many times do people go and they'll stand on a ledge or they'll take their own life how many times do alcoholics drink themselves to death, blow their brains out, overdose on pills, put a plastic bag, as my friend Frank did, around his head with a rubber band and take their own life because there's something they can't face that they're too embarrassed to ever, anybody ever found out about. Whether they cheated on their wife or they've been stealing from their company or maybe they've been screwing around with pills and they can't change their sobriety date and they would rather die than be embarrassed. Pride's a powerful thing. And I'll tell you something. If you have the disposition where you would rather sacrifice your life than your pride, there is something out of balance in you. That is not a good sign. There's something wrong with your spirit. Your self-esteem and ego are out of balance. You have a lot of ego. You'll die rather than look bad. And obviously, no core, no self-esteem, if it's that important to you. Bottom of page 65, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first three columns of the fourth step is not really the thrust of the fourth step. It is a necessary indulgence into victimization that is absolutely necessary to do the real magic and the real healing work of the next two pages, page 66 and 67. If you only, and I've met people that do this, they do their fourth step and they do the first three columns and that's it. And I'll tell you something, if you do that, you will get sicker because you've just victimized yourself at depth. What you've done is you've pulled out every case file and your whole resentment you've had in your whole life and put it on paper and showed how they screwed with you, they interfered with you, they threatened you, they hurt you. That's not it. But that's necessary in order to do the healing. The magic that we're going to talk about on the next two pages is the thing that really changes us, that gives us that 180-degree turn that gets me free. So we considered it carefully. Looking at these three, how much I've been a victim, the first three columns, the first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Very apparent to me. Nobody ever really understood or treated me right. You know, it's no wonder by the time some of us get here, we've victimized ourselves so much by our resentments. A lot of us get here, we get that feeling like no one's ever done so much for so many, so often, for so little. You know, we feel like you get the holes in your hands from the cross, you know. But the book says to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got, and the usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Even if I changed towns and I got away from you, you know a funny thing would happen? Some idiot would show up and be just like you somewhere else. And what happened is I stayed. I could get away from you, but I couldn't get away from the center of judgment in me. I couldn't get away from the guy that kept putting me in that place of conflict. I couldn't get away from me. And I stayed sore. I was locked in a pissed off position all my life, always on edge, always a little bit uptight, always anxious, always defensive, always afraid of being wrong. Pathetically afraid of being wrong. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us. We stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. And the reason that happens is, you see, when I unleash the dogs of judgment, they don't just bite you. They always come back and bite the master. So just as I've gone through life being hard on you and putting you down for being imperfect, then I get alone with myself, and, you know, I can't shut that off. I do the same thing to me. And that's why I feel inadequate and I feel like worthless and I feel ashamed of myself and I'm full of remorse and I ain't perfect either and I can't stand it because I can't allow you not to be perfect and I can't allow me not to be either. I am a tough, just as I'm a tough taskmaster with you, I end up doing the same thing with me. That's why in the we'll get to this in the ninth step, but in step nine, there's nowhere in step nine where it talks about making amends to yourself. Nowhere. That's crap that is bleeded in here from well-meaning counselors and treatment centers. What happens in step four through nine is that I will come, as we're going to get into this, I will come to take you, understand you, and forgive you and accept you as is, really, and take you off the hook. And the funniest thing happens is I reduce the level of judgment in my own life and take all the other people off the hook and start to have understanding and compassion for them and see how I could have done that stuff and I ain't perfect, they're not perfect, we're on the same page here. As I do that to them, what happens is I go home at night and I put my head on the pillow and my head doesn't have to work me over no more. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I have to reel in the dogs of judgment. And when I get them to stop biting you, you know what happens? They don't bite me either. That's why there's nowhere in Alcoholics Anonymous where I make amends to myself. I make amends to you, and what happens is I end up feeling different about myself. Cause and effect. Next paragraph. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. When I'm resentful, I am not happy. And it's futile. You know what's so futile about it? Do you ever sit for hours and plot revenge and you never do anything? It's pathetic. You go through your head, I'm going to blow their house up. I'm going to kill their kids. I'm going to burn them alive. I'm going to run them over. I'm going to poison their dog. And you never do anything. And it just, if you're like me, it's you get to the choice where I either have to do all of that and risk prison for the rest of my life, or now I feel even more pathetic because I'm a blowhard in my own mind. Right? It's like it's pathetic. It's futile and unhappy. Resentful people are not happy people, and they live a futile existence. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours which might have been worthwhile? But worse, with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. If we are to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholic, these things are poison. You know, I don't think they're being dramatic there. You know, where it talks about they're infinitely grave, they're fatal, they'll kill us, the insanity of alcohol will be shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, they're poison, the insanity of alcohol will return, we'll drink, for us to drink again is to die. They're saying this is fatal. I don't think they're being over dramatic. I'll tell you about me. You get me locked up inside my own head, grinding away at something that I can't let go of. And I am completely shut off from any sunlight in my life at all. If God, as he does in my life, talks to me through people, when I got a deep resentment, I can be in a meeting, God could try to be talking to me, and I ain't hearing nothing. Because I'm in my head thinking about getting even. I can't pray. There's no conscious contact in my life when I got a deep resentment. I get down on my knees. I say, God, please help me to stay sober, and I'd sure like to kill that son of a bitch. It just bleeds into everything. It bleeds into everything. I am absolutely shut off. And I'll tell you what happens. See, with a bottle of wine, I can sit for hours and plot revenge and feel good about it. But sober, it's brutal. Because comes a point where I'm like the rat. I don't want any more cheese. I just want out of the trap. There comes a point with deep-seated resentments where I start to hunger for, I got to get out of here. I got to get out. I can't do this anymore. And I start hungering for freedom, and I want to bust out. I want to get away from this. And the only thing I've ever known that in my whole life that instantaneously could free me when I'm locked up inside me like that is about a pint of whiskey. And a pint of whiskey or a certain amount of alcohol could free me. And if you lock me up inside of me long enough and start putting the screws to me, my alcoholism starts putting the screws to me, eventually I'm going to risk a lot of crap in order to get free. I'll ignore the fact that the last 10 times I drank it was awful and almost destroyed me. I'll ignore the fact that it didn't work the last couple times I drank, that I was just as pitiful drunk as I was when I was sober. I'll ignore the fact that it hadn't really been fun for probably the last 5 years that I drank. I'll chance one more time that I might get the sense of ease and comfort in it that I'd once found when I was 18 and 20 years old. Because my emotions by this time will have driven me insane. Locked up in here with the resentment grinding away, I go crazy. Danger. And I don't know how long I can stay that way until I eventually have to get relief. Eventually. So we turn back to the list. Now we're getting into the real meat. The next three paragraphs is really the deal. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Hopefully, by this time in this process, I want to be free of me more than I want to be right. That I want to have peace more than I want to have revenge. That I want to be God's guy. That I don't want to be the guy that's running the universe anymore. I don't want to be the divine dispenser of justice. That I want to be free. And if I'm prepared to look at this from a different angle, here's what will happen. It says, we began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. They owned me. They owned me. The people that I resented owned me. They owned my thoughts, my consciousness, my very life. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. Fancied or real. I'll tell you what I discovered. And I've talked to a lot of people, and I think most of us, when we do this, discover this, that almost all of them are fancied. And yet they look real to me. Even when there's a few kernels of truth, I build this whole fantasy case around them. That by the time I've run it through my head a dozen times, after 4 or 5 years later, there's not much reality left in it at all. And I can hate and want to kill people that haven't even done anything to me, but I think they're about to. I'll tell you an example. When it says these wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, have the power to kill. When I was new in sobriety, there was a guy named Bill, and Bill was a good member of AA. He was sober a long time. And Bill was the kind of guy that he did what I try to do now in my home group, is he would reach out to new people and he would invite us out to coffee with him after meetings. And we'd sit in coffee shops until wee hours of the morning talking about AA. And one night, and I'm pretty new, I sat in a coffee shop and it was Bill and I were alone. Everybody else had left. And I, because he was easy to talk to, and I found myself sharing a couple things with him that I'd never told anybody in my life. I told my sponsor, and that was the only other person for a long time that ever knew this stuff. And the stuff I'm talking about is the stuff that everybody I've ever met in AA comes here with. That one or two things that you're real ashamed of. And the incidents and the circumstances of the incidents for all of us are different. Some people, it might be that you were really drunk and you went off somewhere and forgot your kids and left them somewhere, and it just haunts you. Maybe for other people, it's something you did to your mother or your father that you can't forgive yourself for. Or maybe you had a dog that just loved you with that unconditional love, and one hungover, sick, angry, intolerant morning, you kicked the dog because it tried to lick your face because you hated yourself so much. Or maybe you stole some money and you can't ever imagine, you don't want anybody to know about it, you feel bad about it. Or maybe you had inappropriate sex with something outside your species or something. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Maybe you beat your kids. Maybe you had, I don't know. But I know one thing. I've never met an alcoholic that didn't get sober with something they were ashamed of, a secret that they've been carrying around. And I sat in that restaurant that night and I told Bill about these things I'd never told anybody. And he took it pretty well. He said to me something that sounded a little bit to me like the AA party line. It was something along the lines like, oh, I'm sure you're not the only one that's ever done that, and someday that experience will probably help somebody, you know. And he didn't seem to reject me, and I was watching him, and he's sort of okay, but I had a little quiver in the back of my mind, a little anxiousness about telling him this. Went home that night, and the next day or the day after, I'm not sure, I had my shift changed at work, and all of a sudden I'm working the swing shift. I'm working till midnight every night. And because I'm working to midnight, I didn't see Bill anymore because we went to different meetings. I started going to lunch meetings. He went to night meetings. And I didn't see him for the good part of a year. And I walk into a meeting on my night off one night at a meeting that I normally would never go to. I'd never been to it before. And Bill was there. He's one of the only guys I knew there. Actually, there were a few other guys, but he's one of the guys I knew. And I was glad to see him. And the meeting's about to start. He's across the room. I say, hey, Bill, how you doing, man? Good to see you. And he wouldn't say hi to me. And not only wouldn't he say hi to me, he had this look on his face where he didn't even want to acknowledge me. He didn't even want to look at me. He had a look on his face of what appeared to be contempt, a look of, leave me alone. Get away from me. Leave me alone. And I sat down. The meeting started, and I'm crazy because I'm hurt. I know that this guy has been judging me for that crap I told him. And I guess somewhere inside of me, there was a part of me that couldn't blame him because God knows I judge myself terribly for that stuff. Terribly. And I think I secretly believed that if you knew about it, you would judge me as harshly as I did. And I sat there in that meeting and I'm hurt and I don't hear nothing in the meeting. I'm in my head and I'm getting angrier and angrier and pissed. And I'm thinking what a hypocrite he is. And he tried to act like that didn't bother him. And then I had this spiritual awakening of sorts in the meeting. I thought, wait a minute. The reason he won't look me in the eye and say hi, that son of a bitch has been telling everybody that stuff. And all of a sudden, it was this epiphany experience. I thought, oh my God, that's why that girl would not go out with me. She knows him. He's told, oh my God, and so-and-so is a good friend of his. And now that I think about it, he's been a little off, a little distant now that I think about it. I'm going to kill him. I'm waiting. I'm there cocked and ready. I'm waiting for the meeting to be over. And I am going to beat the crap out of this guy and feel justified doing it because he's destroyed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's told everybody this stuff. And it just makes me crazy. I am insane. And the meeting's about over and I'm ready to go beat him up.